August 4th, 1990. San Antonio, Texas. While walking home from her friend's house, 11-year-old Heidi Seaman goes missing after an apparent abduction. 19 days later, another San Antonio girl, 7-year-old Erica Bateo, is abducted from outside her apartment complex, and the bodies of each victim are eventually found at separate locations one day apart. Investigators look into the possibility that the cases might be connected, and while there are a couple of compelling suspects for each of the crimes, Heidi and Erica's murders are never officially solved. After that, the trail went cold. Hello everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and today, we're going to be exploring two unsolved cold cases which took place in the same city during the same month. The 1990 murders of 11-year-old Heidi Seaman and 7-year-old Erica Bateo. Over the years, I've received a number of requests to cover the Heidi Seaman case, but since the murder of Erica Bateo has always been so closely associated with it, I'm going to be exploring both cases. In August of 1990, the city of San Antonio, Texas went through a very terrifying time when two young girls, Heidi Seaman and Erica Bateo, were abducted within 19 days of each other, and their bodies would eventually be found at separate locations on the same weekend. Since both victims lived in separate sections of the city, investigators have always been inclined to believe that the crimes are not connected, but the two cases are often mentioned in conjunction with each other. There have been some compelling suspects in each of these murders, but there has also been controversy. In the Heidi Seaman case, it seems like different investigative agencies have differing ideas about who the most likely perpetrator is, and ironically, one of the prime suspects was a former supervisor of Heidi's father, who was actively involved in the search effort for her. It seemed like Erica Bateo's case was going to be solved very quickly, as three suspects were immediately charged with her murder, but a grand jury declined to indict them due to insufficient evidence, and there's been debate about whether the initial investigation was botched beyond repair. All we know for certain is that both of these crimes are still unsolved 3 decades later, so we're going to explore both of them on today's episode. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, including stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. As our Patreon page currently has over 60 exclusive bonus episodes in our archives, which are not available on a regular feed. So with all that out of the way, let us now explore the murders of Heidi Seaman and Erica Bateo. Our story begins in San Antonio, Texas in 1990, and our first victim is 11-year-old Heidi Lynn Seaman. Originally born in Grand Forks, North Dakota, Heidi now lives in the northeast side of the city with her parents, Curtis and Teresa Seaman, and older sister Heather, as her father is a senior master sergeant assigned to the Air Force Military Personnel Center at Randolph Air Force Base in Universal City. She is currently enjoying her summer vacation after having completed the fifth grade at Stahl Elementary School. On the morning of Saturday, August the 4th, Heidi had just finished having a sleepover at her friend Whitney's house, and the two girls left together in order to head towards Heidi's home, which was located about a mile away. Whitney would later say that while they were walking down Willow Run Street, they were passed twice by a red car with tinted windows and a thin red stripe. At one point, it slowed down while it was near the two girls, and Whitney noticed that the car was being driven by a white or Hispanic male with dark hair and a mustache, who briefly stared at them before he drove off. At around 11:55 a.m., Heidi and Whitney reached the corner of Willow Run Street and Stahl Road, which was the halfway point between their two houses, and Whitney noticed the red car passing by them a third time. The two girls went their separate ways, as Heidi headed west on Stahl Road, while Whitney started heading back towards her own house. Whitney said that as she was walking, she briefly turned her head around to check on Heidi, but she could no longer see her, and the red car was no longer around either. Even though it was only a few more blocks to Heidi's home, she never arrived there, and when her parents phoned Whitney to find out where she was, they learned that Heidi had seemingly disappeared right after the two girls separated. The Siemens then contacted the San Antonio Police Department in order to report Heidi missing. For the next 3 weeks, Heidi's disappearance would garner massive publicity, and one of the largest search efforts ever performed for a missing child would be launched. Since Curtis Seaman was serving with the United States Air Force, they would devote all their resources they could to help find Heidi, and in total, the search effort would encompass an estimated 1,200 square miles. When San Antonio Mayor Lila Cockrell declared Saturday, August the 11th to be Find Heidi Day, approximately 300,000 people participated in the search, including David Robinson and Willie Anderson of the San Antonio Spurs basketball team. On August the 19th, Heidi's case was featured on the nationally televised crime show America's Most Wanted, where viewers were urged to call a toll-free number if they had any information about her disappearance. Well, 19 days after Heidi went missing, San Antonio would experience another tragedy when a second young girl, 7-year-old Erica Bateo, became the victim of an abduction. Erica lived on the south side of the city at the West End Baptist Manor Apartments on West 35th Street, alongside her mother, Maria Bateo, her three siblings, and Maria's common-law husband, Jesus Rodriguez, who was technically Erica's stepfather. On the afternoon of August the 23rd, Erica and one of her 7-year-old friends were playing outside in the playground of their apartment complex when the friend decided to go back inside. At the time, Maria Bateo was inside her own apartment when she suddenly heard screaming, and when she ran out into the playground, she discovered that Erica was gone. It seemed apparent that Erica had been abducted, so she was reported missing to the San Antonio Police Department. Erica's friend told the police that shortly after she went back into her apartment, she looked out the window and saw Erica talking to a man. After the friend turned away, she heard the same scream that Maria did, and when she looked back outside the window, Erica and the man were gone. When Curtis and Teresa Seaman learned about Erica's disappearance, they immediately reached out to offer their support to Erica's family. They also offered to share their resources from the search effort for Heidi, so members of the Air Force would help look for Erica. Unfortunately for the Seaman family, they would soon receive some tragic news. At around 4:30 p.m. on Saturday, August the 25th, a rancher named Jack Campbell was riding on an all-terrain vehicle with his 3-year-old son on his rural property in Hays County, about 6 miles outside the village of Wimberley. He soon came across a pair of duct-taped trash bags lying about 20 feet away from County Road 220, which had been tied with both a yellow and nylon rope. After realizing that the bags contained a child's body, Campbell contacted the Hays County Sheriff's Office. The body was partially decomposed, and the skull had become detached and was lying a few feet away, though this was likely the result of animal activity rather than the victim being decapitated. Dental records would soon be used to positively identify the victim as Heidi Seaman. Her body was wrapped in a white blanket, and she had her hands tied behind her back with a rope, and after an autopsy was performed, the medical examiner ruled that Heidi was the victim of a homicide. He stated that due to the advanced level of decomposition on her body, it would be almost impossible to conclusively determine if Heidi was sexually assaulted or how she was murdered, though he theorized that she was either strangled or suffocated to death. The location where Heidi was found was about 60 miles northeast from San Antonio. Campbell would later say that 6 days before the discovery of her body, he recalled driving down a narrow pasture road and passing by a white Chrysler LeBaron convertible which had the top down. The vehicle contained two white males, with the driver being a heavy-set man with a military-style crew cut, and the passenger being a thin man. Campbell said that this was in fairly close proximity to the spot where Heidi was later found, and stated, quote, "If you went down that little road, you had to know where you were going," end quote. Well, believe it or not, on Sunday, August the 26th, the day after Heidi's remains were found, there would be a resolution in Erica's case as well, when an airman participating in the search effort for her came across Erica's body in a storm drain located less than a mile away from her apartment. Much like Heidi, Erica was decomposed, and while she was partially clothed and her hands were tied, investigators could not determine if a sexual assault had taken place. It's also unclear if they were able to establish a cause of death, though I've read at least one source state that she was strangled. The funerals for both Heidi and Erica would be held 3 days later, on August the 29th. Right from the outset, authorities did not believe that the two crimes were connected, and it initially seemed like Erica's murder would be resolved very quickly. On August the 24th, 2 days before Erica's body was even found, a 17-year-old suspect named Roderick Jerome Springs was charged with kidnapping, resisting arrest, and failing to identify himself to police officers. Springs suffered from paranoid schizophrenia, and weeks before Erica went missing, he had been charged with assault in an unrelated incident, though the charge was dropped after he agreed to undergo counseling at a mental health facility. Springs popped up on the police's radar when Erica's friend identified him as the man she saw speaking to Erica outside her apartment window, and after Erica's body was found, the charges against Springs were upgraded to capital murder. Shortly thereafter, two other suspects, 31-year-old Sherman Bedford III and 32-year-old Kenneth Earl Pope, were also charged with capital murder for their alleged roles in Erica's death, and all three men would be held in the Bexar County Jail, while the case against them was presented to a grand jury by the Bexar County District Attorney's Office. However, it soon became apparent that the case against them was not exactly rock solid, as Bedford had an IQ of only 53, and there was fear that the police had coerced a confession out of him. In fact, the only reason Pope was even arrested was because Bedford had implicated him as an accomplice. In September, the grand jury issued a no bill of indictment against Pope, which meant they believed the prosecution did not show probable cause to charge him. After serving 24 days in jail, the charges against Pope were dropped and he was released, and the district attorney's office would later state that they no longer believed he had any involvement in the crime and publicly exonerated him. But the authorities still considered Bedford and Springs to be suspects, as they believed that Springs abducted Erica while Bedford drove their getaway car. However, on December the 9th of that year, it was announced that the grand jury had declined to indict Springs and Bedford for Erica's murder due to insufficient evidence, so the capital murder charges were dropped. While Bedford was released from jail, Springs was committed to the San Antonio State Hospital for several months on the resisting arrest charge before being released into the custody of his mother. While the investigation into Erica's murder pretty much hit a brick wall, there would be many more developments in the investigation into Heidi's murder. Her case wound up leading to the creation of a non-profit volunteer organization called the Heidi Search Center, which was named after her, and functioned as a resource to help the families of other missing children and adults. One individual who was instrumental in the creation of the Heidi Search Center was Major Robert Eric Duncan of the United States Air Force. Duncan, who was married and had two children of his own, had been a psychologist at Randolph Air Force Base and was the former supervisor of Heidi's father, Curtis Seaman. Major Duncan was also the operations director who helped coordinate the original search effort for Heidi, and he served as the Heidi Search Center's president from November of 1990 until August of 1991. However, in March of 1992, it was announced that Duncan had become the prime suspect in Heidi's murder. By this point, Duncan was stationed at Brooks Air Force Base in San Antonio, but he was taken into custody by the Air Force Office of Special Investigations, aka the OSI, while a search was performed of his home for evidence. One of the first people to become suspicious of Duncan was Hays County Sheriff Paul Hastings, whose wife, Patty Hastings, was a reporter for a newspaper in Dripping Springs, a rural town located near the spot where Heidi's body was found. In the weeks following Heidi's disappearance, Major Duncan called Patty numerous times to frequently ask questions about the investigation and inquire about whether the FBI was going to become involved. Duncan also allegedly spoke about a series of strange dreams he'd been having about Heidi and started making Patty uncomfortable, so she shared her suspicions about him with her husband. The OSI became interested in Duncan after they were approached by a former co-worker of his from Randolph Air Force Base. The co-worker said that Duncan blamed Curtis Seaman for getting him removed from his supervisory position there and transferred to Brooks Air Force Base, and Duncan allegedly said that he would, quote-unquote, get even with Curtis. Interestingly enough, Duncan's last day at Randolph was August the 3rd, 1990, before he reported for duty at Brooks on August the 6th, and of course, Heidi just happened to be abducted on August the 4th. Duncan was also driving a red car at that time, which matched the description of the vehicle seen passing by Heidi before she went missing, and he did bear a resemblance to the male driver Whitney had seen. After he was taken into custody by the OSI, Duncan was held at the Wilford Hall Medical Center at Lackland Air Force Base for psychological testing. They could only legally hold Duncan for 72 hours without charging him, and since the OSI were unable to uncover any conclusive evidence to prove that he murdered Heidi, he was subsequently released and returned to normal duty. Well, even though the OSI believed that Duncan was the prime suspect, the San Antonio Police Department were not entirely convinced, and in February of 1996, they would announce that they had uncovered a new suspect. At the time, they would not release his name publicly, but years later, it was revealed that the suspect was 39-year-old Jerry Lee Naber, who was known for being a heavy user and dealer of methamphetamine, and was incarcerated at the Dominguez State Jail at that time on drug charges. Naber became a suspect after an eyewitness came forward and told investigators that in August of 1990, during the time period Heidi was missing, he visited Naber's apartment and saw a young girl tied to a chair with her legs open. Her mouth was covered with what appeared to be a bandana, and she was crying, and when the witness asked Naber who the girl was, he supposedly replied, quote, "She's just a little meth whore I found somewhere." In retrospect, the witness now believed that the girl was Heidi Seaman. At that time, Naber operated an auto repair shop on Stahl Road near the spot where Heidi was abducted, and his apartment was located only 6 miles away. Naber also apparently had ties to the town of Wimberley, which was close to where Heidi's body was found. In addition, Naber was known for having a creepy fetish for young girls, as he would apparently force his adult girlfriend to shave her pubic area, wear her hair in pigtails, and dress up like a prepubescent girl in order to give off the appearance of being underage. The San Antonio PD wanted to collect physical evidence from Naber's body, including hairs, blood, and saliva, but when he refused to cooperate, they obtained a court order to do so. The physical evidence was supposedly going to be compared to DNA evidence from Heidi's murder, but even though it was reported that the results came back negative, there's been some confusion about whether or not Naber was cleared as a suspect. I'll be addressing this in more detail later on, but no murder charges were ever filed against Naber. In addition to the witness from Naber's apartment, there were apparently other people who recalled having seen Naber with Heidi, but since they all had criminal backgrounds, they were not considered to be reliable witnesses. Well, by the time Naber popped up on the radar as a suspect, the Seaman family had relocated to Panama City, Florida, and Curtis was stationed at Tyndall Air Force Base. In May of 1996, it was announced that Curtis had filed a murder complaint against Major Robert Eric Duncan under the Uniform Code of Military Justice, which allows one soldier to file charges against another. This would lead to an Article 32 proceeding, which is the military equivalent of a civilian grand jury, in order to determine if Duncan would be court-martialed for Heidi's murder. In September of that year, the hearing was held at Brooks Air Force Base, where Duncan was still stationed, but the base's commander ruled that the evidence against Duncan was insufficient enough to bring him to a court-martial, so the murder complaint was dropped. In August of 2010, the Austin American Statesman published an extensive article about this case in which Elizabeth Greiner, a San Antonio PD cold case detective who was handling the investigation, confirmed that Robert Eric Duncan and Jerry Lee Neighbor were still considered quote-unquote viable targets of the probe. However, the article made it clear that different law enforcement figures from different agencies had differing ideas about who the perpetrator was. For instance, retired Hays County Sheriff Paul Hastings, who handled the investigation into the discovery of Heidi's body, was still convinced that Duncan was the killer, while Jimmy Holguin, the former lead investigator from the San Antonio PD, expressed his belief that Neighbor murdered Heidi. I mentioned earlier that Heidi's murder led to the creation of the Heidi Search Center, who would spend nearly 30 years assisting the families of other missing individuals. But unfortunately, in January of 2018, it was announced that the Heidi Search Center was closing its doors, as there was just not enough funding to keep it operational. In August of 2020, the San Antonio-based TV station, KENS5, produced an extensive 30th anniversary segment on the murders of Heidi Seaman and Erica Pateo. Curtis and Teresa Seaman agreed to be interviewed, but even though Curtis had previously filed a murder complaint against Duncan, he now acknowledged that he was no longer certain that Duncan killed his daughter, stating, quote, "It looked like the case they had against him was fairly strong, but the SAPD didn't believe that. I'm not exactly sure why, but what they showed us as far as a witness rights briefing, you know, I don't know that he did it either. I can't say that for sure, but it sure did seem like that," end quote. However, the Pateo family declined to be interviewed for the segment, and the San Antonio PD also did not wish to discuss Erica's murder. Instead, they had a spokesperson make this statement, quote, "I was advised by the homicide sergeant that the family does not wish to bring light to the case and have asked that we not discuss the case with the media. We are granting the family's wishes and will not be providing the interview. There is no information or evidence that anyone other than the listed suspects were involved in this crime. The case is considered closed by arrest," end quote. However, the Bexar County District Attorney did state, quote, "Because there is no statute of limitations for the offense of capital murder, should the investigating agency obtain new evidence and file a case with our office for review, we could present it to a grand jury for possible indictment," end quote. By the time the Seamans conducted their interview, they had already experienced another tragedy, as Heidi's older sister Heather died unexpectedly in 2019. I also wanted to mention that Heidi's mother Teresa has also apparently passed away. Even though I could not find an obituary for her, I did find one for Heidi's paternal grandmother, Anna Marie Seaman, who died in April of 2022, and it said that she was preceded in death by her daughter-in-law, Teresa Seaman. So after 3 decades, the murders of Heidi Seaman and Erica Pateo both continue to remain unsolved. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. So if you look up the coverage of these two cases, you'll find comments from numerous people who were living in San Antonio in 1990 and confirmed that losing Heidi Seaman and Erica Pateo within the same month was an absolutely terrifying experience. Even though San Antonio was already a fairly large city at that point, this was described as a time period in which the city pretty much lost its innocence and everyone became afraid to allow their children to play outside or walk anywhere on their own. Of course, while I'm sure there was some initial fear that a serial child predator may have been in the area who was abducting young girls, I'll state right up front that I do not believe these crimes are related, and law enforcement has always felt the same way. In spite of this, the two cases are often mentioned alongside each other, though I don't think anyone will argue that Heidi Seaman's story is much more well-known than Erica Bateo's. Heidi's murder got a lot more media coverage, and she literally had a non-profit organization named after her, while Erica's case pretty much faded from the spotlight. You're not going to find too many sources out there which exclusively focus on Erica's murder, as the vast majority of them mention her in conjunction with Heidi's case. Of course, this has led to discussion about the disparity of coverage with certain types of victims in the media. While Heidi was a white girl from an upper middle class family whose father was in the Air Force, Erica was a Hispanic girl from a lower income area whose family was a bit more dysfunctional. But I suppose the ironic thing is that if Heidi had not been abducted less than 3 weeks earlier and caused such a massive search effort within the city, who knows if Erica's abduction would have gotten much, if any, attention at all. Remember, Erica's body was ultimately found by an airman, and the main reason the Air Force even became involved in her search effort is because Curtis Seaman reached out to provide support to the Bateo family and offered to share resources from Heidi's search effort with them. But there are other factors in why Heidi's coverage got much more coverage than Erica's. For starters, three suspects were charged with Erica's murder immediately after her body was found, so it initially seemed like her death was not going to be a cold case at all, until the grand jury elected not to indict these suspects months later. And since law enforcement seemed certain that these were the right guys, and there was no need to pursue alternate leads, they pretty much held the mindset that there wasn't anything else they could do unless someone came forward with new information. This is in sharp contrast to Heidi's murder, where no one was named as a potential suspect for years. Another complicating factor is that even though Heidi's parents did everything they could to keep their daughter's case in the spotlight and raise awareness of her story, there were other issues taking place in Erica's family, and her mother, Maria Bateo, completely shied away from publicity. At the time, Maria and her children were living with her common-law husband, Jesus Rodriguez, but this sounded like an abusive relationship, as Jesus was a very controlling spouse who handled all the family business himself, including the grocery shopping, and kept Maria completely isolated from the world. And to give you an idea of what a stand-up guy Jesus was, he moved out of their apartment the day after Erica's body was found, and within a month, Maria filed for divorce from him. In spite of this, Maria and Jesus would continue an on-again, off-again relationship for the next 2 years, but it appears that the only reason he stuck around is because they filed a $1 million personal injury lawsuit against the West End Baptist Manor Apartments for an incident where Erica's brother was electrocuted when his hand brushed against faulty wiring from a lamppost in the apartment complex's playground, which they believe caused him to develop a learning disability. Since this incident took place in 1987, the 3-year statute of limitations had expired, though Maria did eventually receive $7,000 from a settlement. By that point, Maria had finalized her divorce with Jesus, so he got none of that money, and Maria managed to move away and start over with her 3 surviving children. As odd as this might sound, Erica's murder actually paved the way for this to happen, as the search effort for Erica allowed Maria to connect with some compassionate people who helped her break free from her toxic relationship and develop some independence. This included a city councilman named Bob Thompson, who helped Maria and her family seek new housing and later became her divorce lawyer. But of course, the trauma of losing her daughter and having to adjust to living on her own was pretty overwhelming for Maria, which is why she has always stayed away from the spotlight and declined to give interviews to the media about Erica's case. I have no idea what Maria's thoughts are, but for all we know, perhaps she believes that the suspects who were originally charged with this crime back in 1990 were the killers, and if there's not much else the police can do at this point, why keep reliving the trauma? Getting back to the cases, it appears that the murders of Heidi and Erica each have their own set of separate suspects, and since they lived in completely separate sections of San Antonio, I can definitely understand why law enforcement never believed the two crimes were connected. Since there's far less information available about Erica's case, I'm going to start off by analyzing her murder before I move on to Heidi's case. I previously mentioned that when KENS-TV produced a 30th anniversary news segment about these two crimes in August of 2020, both Erica's family and the San Antonio Police Department declined to be interviewed about her case, and a police spokesman stated, quote, "There is no information or evidence that anyone other than the listed suspects were involved in this crime. The case is considered closed by arrest," end quote. Well, the term closed by arrest is kind of an odd one, as the Bexar County District Attorney's Office gave their own statement that the door is still open to file charges in Erica's case if new evidence were to surface. What adds an extra element of confusion is that one of the three suspects who was charged with the crime back in 1990 was publicly exonerated by the District Attorney's Office, and I have no idea of the current whereabouts of the other two suspects, or if they're even still alive. I get the impression that a lot of details about the original arrests were withheld from the public, but based on the information we do have, here's my interpretation of what appeared to have happened. The first suspect, Roderick Jerome Springs, was actually taken into custody 2 days before Erica's body was found, and he was charged with kidnapping, resisting arrest, and failing to identify himself to police officers. Before Erica was abducted, one of her friends had seen her talking with a man from her apartment window, and I'm guessing that the friend identified Springs, but the authorities would not file capital murder charges against him until they could confirm Erica was dead. Now, we know that Springs suffered from paranoid schizophrenia and had a history of assault, so I'm guessing that he did not react well to the police's attempts to question him, and this is what led to the resisting arrest charge. A few days later, the second suspect, Sherman Bedford III, was charged with capital murder, and while I'm not sure if Erica's friend or any other witnesses placed Bedford at the abduction scene, investigators seem to believe that he drove the getaway car after Springs grabbed Erica. We know that Erica was eventually found in a storm drain less than a mile away from her apartment, but while I have no idea where these two guys supposedly took her and killed her, the medical examiner did not believe Erica was alive for very long after she was abducted. Now, it sounds like the third suspect, Kenneth Earl Pope, was charged with murder based solely on the fact that Bedford implicated him as an accomplice, and this is where the investigation becomes problematic. Bedford only had an IQ of 53, and it's been alleged that the police coerced him into making a confession, a situation you will find in numerous wrongful conviction cases. While it's still possible that Bedford was involved in this crime, it seems clear that he falsely implicated Pope, as not only were the charges against Pope dropped, but the district attorney's office did publicly clear him and flat out stated that he had nothing to do with Erica's murder. I read one source which said that it was established that Pope had an alibi placing him at work that day, and it was an unfortunate situation that he was dragged into this whole ordeal. I wish we had more details about the relationships between Springs, Bedford, and Pope, as Springs was only 17 years old, and I'm not sure why he would be participating in the abduction and murder of a child with one or more individuals who were in their early 30s. But even if Springs and Bedford were guilty all along, the fact that investigators supposedly coerced them into implicating an innocent man is a major red flag. Years later, Pope actually made an attempt to sue the city of San Antonio for violating his civil rights, but the lawsuit was unsuccessful. So I'm sure there might have been evidence against Springs and Bedford which was not disclosed to the public, but regardless, the case against them wasn't sufficient enough for a grand jury to hand down murder indictments. From the information we do know, it seems like the primary evidence was a possibly questionable confession from Bedford and Erica's friend identifying Springs as the man she saw with Erica outside the apartment complex. But we know that eyewitness identification can often be unreliable, particularly when the witness is a 7-year-old child, so I'm sure this girl's testimony was not strong enough to take Springs to trial. After the charges were dropped and both men were released from jail, Bedford just seemed to drop out of sight, but in January of 1994, Springs' mother filed a missing persons report for him after he stopped taking his medication and took off from their home. He was later found attempting to rip away the shutters and screen from an elderly woman's bedroom window in the east side of San Antonio, and after she called the police, an officer found Springs at a nearby bus stop. When the officer approached Springs, a violent struggle ensued, which left both men with injuries, and Springs was charged with attempted burglary with intent to commit theft and resisting arrest. However, the charges were later dropped after it was ruled that Springs was not mentally competent to stand trial, and I have no idea what happened to him afterward. It really does seem like after all these years, the San Antonio PD still believes that Springs and Bedford were responsible for Erica's murder, but while that very well may be true, the questionable nature of the original investigation and the vulnerability of the two suspects has left some doubt. And even if they are both guilty, would it still be possible to build a strong enough case against them at this point to secure a conviction at trial? One crucial aspect of this case I'm still not clear about is how much, if any, DNA evidence is available, as that could conclusively link a suspect to this crime, even if they are already deceased. But law enforcement has never confirmed or denied this, and they may simply have the mindset that Springs and Bedford were the right guys all along, and without any further corroborating evidence, there's just simply nothing else they can do. Whatever the case, all we can really do is keep Erica's story in the spotlight and hope that it might lead to a resolution someday. So now we're going to move on to discussing Heidi's case, which is a lot more complex, considering that different investigative agencies seem to have differing ideas about who is actually responsible for this crime. One of the main reasons that Heidi's abduction haunted so many people is that it appeared to take place within a split second, demonstrating that it's possible for something like this to happen to anyone at any time. As you recall, Heidi was in the midst of walking home and parted ways with her friend Whitney, but Whitney said that as she was heading in the opposite direction, she briefly turned her head around and noticed that Heidi was suddenly gone. I don't think it's much of a mystery what happened here, as it seems obvious that the male driver of the red car, which passed down the street multiple times, was responsible for Heidi's abduction, and they managed to speed out of the area before Whitney saw anything. The only thing we don't know is the identity of this driver, and figuring that out has proven to be quite a challenge. While Erica's body was found less than a mile away from where she was abducted, whoever killed Heidi went to the trouble of disposing her body 60 miles outside San Antonio. So could this mean that the perpetrator did not live in the San Antonio area? Or did they make a calculated choice to drive that far in order to put some distance between the crime and themselves? After all, Heidi's disappearance was subject to a massive search effort, so it definitely would have been in the killer's best interest to dump her body at a spot way outside San Antonio. This also could have created potential jurisdictional issues, as it was the Hays County Sheriff's Office who investigated the discovery of Heidi's body, and it's still never been conclusively established where she was killed. Even though the medical examiner was unable to determine Heidi's exact time of death, they estimated that she had been alive no more than 48 hours after she was abducted. However, there is one piece of evidence which doesn't get discussed all that much, and suggests that Heidi may have been in captivity for a window of time before she was killed. During my research, I found a slideshow about this case at the website mysanantonio.com, which mentioned that at the time she was abducted, Heidi was dressed in a t-shirt, shorts, white socks, and tennis shoes, and was carrying a bag containing the night clothes she had worn during her sleepover at Whitney's house. But when Heidi's body was found 3 weeks later, she was dressed only in her nightshirt and socks. I hadn't seen this detail about the nightshirt mentioned anywhere else, but then I found a true crime podcast called The Rap Sheet, which is co-hosted by Thomas Edwards, a retired crime reporter from the San Antonio Express News, who obviously has a lot of first-hand knowledge of Heidi's murder. On one of his episodes about the case, Edwards read from the original autopsy report and confirmed that Heidi was only wearing her nightshirt and socks when she was found and did not even have any underwear on. He also mentioned that a brown men's sock with duct tape on it was found at the scene near Heidi's body and may have been used as a gag, but I'll talk more about that detail later on. It's never been made clear to me if the rest of Heidi's clothing was ever found, but it is odd that she would be clad in a different piece of clothing than what she was wearing at the time of her abduction. Even if the killer undressed Heidi and sexually assaulted her, why go to the trouble of putting the nightshirt back on her body? Could this mean she was held in captivity and chained clothing at some point? It's a point worth discussing, since as we're going to talk about momentarily, a witness had reported seeing Heidi inside the apartment of one of the suspects. So over the past 3 decades, only 2 men have been publicly named as suspects, and they couldn't be more polar opposites. Major Robert Eric Duncan, a married man with children who was enlisted in the Air Force and played a prominent role in the search effort, and Jerry Lee Naber, a career criminal with a history of meth issues and creepy behavior. Obviously, if you were to compare the backgrounds of both men, Naber appears to be a far more likely candidate to be the killer, but Duncan has received more publicity. What's crazy about this whole situation is that Duncan became the president of the Heidi Search Center, and if he is guilty, then this might be the only documented case that I know of where a killer wound up running a non-profit organization named after the victim they murdered, which is all sorts of messed up. Since Duncan was so active in the original search effort for Heidi, it would definitely be the ultimate act of misdirection to dispose of her body at a location such a great distance away from the search area. But let's look at the case against each of these men, and start with Duncan. One of the biggest complications with this whole situation is that while the Air Force Office of Special Investigations put all their focus on Duncan, the San Antonio Police Department were not entirely convinced, and we're dealing with 2 different justice systems here. To recap, Duncan was first named as a suspect in March of 1992, but there was not enough evidence to file charges against him. In February of 1996, the San Antonio PD started looking at Naber as a suspect, and it seemed like Duncan might be on his way to having his name cleared, but then in May, Curtis Seaman filed a murder complaint against Duncan under the Uniform Code of Military Justice. Now, obviously, this sort of thing would not happen in a civilian murder investigation, as a victim's family can't just decide to file a murder complaint against a suspect and have the case against them taken to a grand jury. Duncan had actually been on the verge of retiring from the Air Force during this time period, but the whole process was put on administrative hold so an Article 32 hearing could take place to decide if Duncan would stand in front of a court-martial. I mean, I can understand why Curtis would do this and attempt to go after the man he believed murdered his daughter, but it's very odd timing that this would happen when the San Antonio PD were looking at an entirely different suspect. What if Duncan had been given a court-martial and then the police suddenly uncovered new evidence which pointed towards Naber? If either of these men went on trial, I would think the fact that a different investigative agency was simultaneously looking at another suspect would have the potential to create reasonable doubt. Curtis has said that even though he was convinced at the time that Duncan was the killer, he is no longer certain. I know that after Duncan was first named as a suspect in 1992, it would have a very negative impact on his life. As an example, the local YMCA asked him to resign as volunteer coach of his son's basketball team. Duncan and his family eventually relocated to Virginia, but in July of 2007, he made the news again after an elementary school in Charlottesville was planning to hire his wife, Deborah Duncan, to be their new principal, but then suddenly pulled her offer for what they described as, quote-unquote, unforeseen circumstances. While the school board never officially confirmed this, Duncan believed they had found out he was a murder suspect and wanted nothing to do with his family. At one point, Duncan said he was planning to write a book about Heidi's case in order to share his side of the story, but it was never completed. If Duncan's wife was still with him at that point, then she obviously didn't think there was any truth to the accusations that he was a murderer. So if he was innocent, then you have to feel bad that she lost a job over this whole situation, and that this case has essentially ruined Duncan's life. So why did Duncan pop up on the radar as a suspect to begin with? Well, Jerry Goldstein, an attorney Duncan had hired, would tell the press, quote, "If you recall, he was very active in the search for the young victim, and sometimes, whether it's justified or not, the investigators, and this happens in the civilian world just as much as in the military, that makes you a target," end quote. Another law enforcement figure who believed that Duncan was the killer was Hayes County Sheriff Paul Hastings, and this was based largely on some strange phone calls Duncan made to his newspaper reporter wife, Patty Hastings. On the surface, it might not seem unusual that someone so involved in the search effort for Heidi would ask her so many questions, but Patty thought that Duncan seemed way too obsessive about the whole situation and was creeped out when he started talking about these weird dreams he had about Heidi, which prompted Patty's editor to start calling him a quote-unquote fruitcake. Paul and Patty Hastings have since passed away, but while Sheriff Hastings may have had some inherent bias over the whole situation, this means that another investigative agency besides the San Antonio PD are convinced that Duncan is the killer. Now, there are certainly documented cases of people becoming suspects in a murder because they seem to have an unhealthy obsession with the crime, such as Steve Pankey and the Janelle Matthews case. I've watched contemporary footage of a few TV interviews Duncan conducted during the 1990s, and on the surface, he seems like an ordinary enough guy, and I don't get any outwardly creepy vibes from him. But when Duncan became president of the Heidi Search Center, he resigned from the position after being voted out during the summer of 1991, and I'd be curious to learn more details about this. Did he do or say anything which compelled the center to get rid of him? The other reason Duncan popped up on the radar is because a former co-worker of his told the OSI that Duncan had allegedly threatened to, quote-unquote, get even with Curtis because he caused him to lose his supervisory position at Randolph Air Force Base and be transferred out. Heidi's murder just happened to take place on the weekend between when Duncan left Randolph and started his new position at Brooks Air Force Base. When asked about his whereabouts on the morning Heidi went missing, Duncan said he was at home, but I'm not sure if he had any witnesses to verify this. The driver of the red car which likely abducted Heidi was described as being a white or Hispanic male with dark hair and a mustache, and while Duncan matched that description, so did millions of other men in the United States at that time, and I doubt that Heidi's friend Whitney got a good enough look at the driver to make a positive identification. Whitney also did not provide a make, model, or license number for the red car, but she did describe it as having tinted windows and a thin red stripe, and Duncan was apparently driving a car like that at the time. But there really isn't any slam dunk evidence to indicate that Duncan was responsible for this crime. I have to say that I do have issues with the alleged motive that Duncan murdered Heidi as revenge against Curtis for getting him transferred. For starters, Duncan has always denied that he ever said he would get even with Curtis, and even though Curtis has given a number of interviews over the years, I've never actually heard him or anyone else confirm that he played a role in Duncan losing his position or if there were any serious issues between them. And even if the two men did dislike each other, would Duncan really go so far as to murder an innocent child over the whole situation? The guy was a father with two children of his own, so this just seems like an incredibly extreme reaction to a workplace dispute. Another issue is that Heidi had slept over at Whitney's house and was in the midst of walking home when she was abducted. If this was a premeditated revenge scheme, how could Duncan have known that Heidi would be on this particular road at this particular time? The circumstances of how Heidi was abducted do seem to point towards a random predator passing through the area who just happened to notice Heidi and decided to go after her once she separated from Whitney. Look, I'm not going to say with absolute certainty that Duncan didn't commit this crime, as there may be more information we don't know about which makes him a compelling suspect. One detail I mentioned earlier, which could point towards him, is the brown sock found near Heidi's body, as brown is a color of sock you would typically expect to see worn with Air Force uniforms. It seems obvious the sock did not belong to Heidi, and I would love to know if it has ever been tested for DNA. But speaking of DNA, let's start discussing Jerry Lee Naber, as there's been some confusion about whether or not he is still a viable suspect. He certainly fits the profile of someone you would expect to commit a crime like this, and while I'm not sure if he was ever charged or accused of any other crimes against children, the stories of his attempts to fetishize his girlfriend by getting her to act like a little girl are incredibly creepy. As a side note, it's been reported that Naber was also investigated as a potential suspect in another famous cold case, the abduction and murder of 3-year-old Rachel Runyon, which took place in Sunset, Utah in August of 1982, but it doesn't look like this went anywhere. What we do know is that Neighbor operated an auto repair shop on Stahl Road, where Heidi was last seen, and he lived in an apartment only 6 miles away, so I can definitely see a situation unfolding where he was passing through the area and just happened to notice Heidi, and then felt compelled to abduct her. One detail which isn't so clear is whether or not Neighbor owned a red car in 1990, but even if he didn't, could he have possibly had access to one at his auto repair shop? The main reason Neighbor became a suspect in 1996 is because of a witness who claimed he had seen a girl tied to a chair in Neighbor's apartment during the time period when Heidi went missing. Needless to say, there were a lot of issues with this witness's story, not only because they apparently had a criminal record, but because they waited 5.5 years to come forward. You can understand the frustration, because if the story was true, and this witness had immediately gone to the police, perhaps she could have been saved before Neighbor murdered her. And even if the witness was also a criminal and a terrible person, would Neighbor really be so brazen as to put a captive girl on display like that when he had a visitor to his apartment? Remember, the original search effort for Heidi was a huge story back then, and there was even a reward being offered for information, so it definitely would not have been in Neighbor's best interest to do this. But on the other hand, I'm sure the witness was aware that if they went to the authorities after so many years of remaining silent, they would face a major negative backlash, so why make up a story like that if it wasn't true? By that point, Neighbor was incarcerated on drug charges, so maybe this witness felt more comfortable enough to contact the authorities. It's also been reported that there were apparently other witnesses who had seen Neighbor and Heidi together, but they were not deemed to be credible due to their own criminal histories. Part of me does hope that this story is not true, as it's horrifying to think of Heidi being held in captivity and abused like that for a prolonged period of time. But now we have to talk about whether or not Neighbor was eliminated as a suspect via DNA evidence. We know that hairs, blood, and saliva were taken from him in 1996, and the results from the DNA comparison came back negative, but there have been many sources since then, such as the aforementioned Austin American Statesman article from 2010, which state that Neighbor is still a viable suspect, and former lead detective Jimmy Holguin has repeatedly stated that he's convinced Neighbor was the guy. Well, you have to remember that this original testing took place nearly 30 years ago, and DNA profiling has evolved and advanced so much since then. So even if none of the physical evidence matched Neighbor at the time, that may not necessarily mean he was excluded. Furthermore, we really don't know anything about the quantity or quality of the DNA evidence. Heidi's body was decomposed when she was found, and since they couldn't conclusively determine if she was sexually assaulted, I'm guessing there wasn't any semen left behind by the perpetrator. I have heard that hairs and carpet textile fibers were found in the dirt underneath Heidi's body and collected as evidence, so perhaps this was used to make a forensic comparison with Neighbor and came back negative. Some of the other items found at the scene, such as the garbage bags, ropes, duct tape, and brown sock, could be a source of potential DNA, but I'm not sure if they've ever been tested. Overall, while a compelling case could be made that either Duncan or Neighbor is the killer, compelling cases could also be made for neither of them being the killer as well. While Duncan has continued to pop up in the spotlight in the years following the crime, I have no idea of Neighbor's current whereabouts or if he's even still alive. For all we know, perhaps neither of these men are guilty, and the real perpetrator is a suspect who has managed to stay off the radar these past 3 decades. Remember, Jack Campbell, the rancher who found Heidi's body, had reported seeing a white convertible driving through the area 6 days earlier, which contained 2 men, and while it's possible they were nothing more than innocent bystanders, Campbell said this was a road which ordinarily did not get a lot of traffic. I do have the same feeling of uncertainty with Erica Bateo's murders, because even though law enforcement still seems certain that Roderick Springs and Sherman Bedford were the perpetrators, I don't have enough information to say with any conclusiveness if these were the right guys. The only thing I'm fairly certain of is that these crimes are probably unrelated and were each committed by different perpetrators, and it's just a coincidence that they happen to take place in the same city so close to each other. But until an arrest is made in one or both of these cases, they will always remain linked together, and their loved ones deserve to finally receive justice. Heidi Seaman's murder investigation is currently being handled by the Texas Rangers, so if you have any information about her case, please contact them at the Texas Department of Public Safety's Missing Persons Hotline at 1-800-346-3243. That's 1-800-346-3243. And if you happen to have any information on the murder of Erica Bateo, please contact the San Antonio Police Department at 210-207-7273. That's 210-207-7273. You can also contact the Texas Crime Stoppers hotline for either of these cases at 1-800-252-TIPS. That's 1-800-252-8477. But if you have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Another reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. Over the past 5 years, our Patreon page has released nearly 70 exclusive bonus episodes, which are all currently available in our archives for our patrons in tiers 2 and 3. This past month, I actually released a bonus episode about the 1981 murder of Rhonda Hinson, which is technically our podcast's very first edition of The Trail Revisited. I covered that story all the way back on episode number 4 nearly 8 years ago, but since I've learned a ton of new information in recent years, I decided to take a fresh look at the case and put together an entirely new episode. I've also dropped an exclusive bonus episode from my spin-off podcast, The Path Went Chilly, in which myself and my two co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, discussed the 2006 disappearance of Maureen Fields. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries, and we now have nearly 60 of these commentary tracks in our archives. I'd also like to give a shout out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Yolanda, Susie G, JK, Nicholas M, Stacy B, Eileen G, and Trina W. Thank you all so much for your support. And before we bring this episode to a close, I'd like to play a promo for another true crime podcast titled The Last Trip.
Do you love true crime and traveling? Having traveled the world solo the last couple of years and being obsessed with true crime, I found myself researching others who took the same vacations but never made it home. The Last Trip is a true crime podcast covering missing and murdered people that were living their best lives on vacation. I'm your host, Jamie Beebe, and each week I'll bring you on The Last Trip, taking a deep dive into vacation culture and travel spots, tips on staying alive while traveling, and ultimately recreating someone's last days in paradise. What led to their last trip? And could you be next? Kiara Henry vanished from Maui, Hawaii while traveling solo, and after extensive searches, there are still no leads. Did she meet with the wrong person, fall into the ocean, or simply walk away from her life? Elijah Snow and his wife were celebrating their 10th wedding anniversary in Cancun, Mexico. Elijah was last seen on camera walking up the steps to his hotel room only minutes after his wife got in the elevator to also go to bed. He was found dead the next morning, beaten and stuck in a window at an abandoned neighboring resort. The Mexican authorities said it was an accident. His family said it was murder. Join me, Jamie Beebe, co-host of the popular true crime series Strictly Stalking, as I embark on a brand new adventure combining true crime and travel. Listen to The Last Trip wherever you get your podcasts, and follow The Last Trip on Instagram at The Last Trip Crime Pod.
I'm also excited to announce that The Trail Went Cold will be returning again to the True Crime Podcast Festival this year, which is being held at the Denver Marriott Westminster in Denver, Colorado, from July the 12th until the 14th. If you would like to purchase tickets, we have a discount code for 15% off, so please visit truecrimepodcastfestival.com and enter the promo code TRAIL. Once again, that's truecrimepodcastfestival.com, and the promo code is TRAIL for 15% off tickets. I just wanted to give another shout out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum, and the Unresolved Mystery subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter and Instagram, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. So have yourselves a great week and join us again next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm sorry.